I think one of the myths of inclusion is it's a one-size-fits-all, and that we're just taking students out of segregated spaces and just putting them into the general ed class that you remember in your mind. And what we're really doing is we're teaching differently. We're anticipating variability across every classroom. When you expect that, you plan for it differently. You collaborate and use the expertise of multiple educators in the space, and that teaming becomes so paramount because each educator brings expertise about content, about accessibility, about disability, around language acquisition. All those things matter. And kids learn so much from their peers. So when we keep peers separate or segregated and don't allow them to learn how to connect with each other, I think we're maybe overinflating our importance as teachers and under recognizing all the learning that happens between peers.
Hey friends, welcome back to Think Inclusive, real conversations about building schools where every learner belongs. I'm your host, Tim Villegas. Today's episode is about what it actually takes to move a whole school system towards real and authentic inclusion. Not just a one-time initiative, but a long-term shift in beliefs, routines, and how we teach. We zoom out to the district level, but keep it grounded in what educators see and feel every day. Expectations, belonging, and the practical work of making classrooms work for more students. Our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Spencer Imes, an educational leader focused on leading collaboratively for transformational change. She's the deputy superintendent for a medium-sized school district in Oregon and co-author of the book Leading for All, Creating Truly Inclusive and Excellent Schools. We talk about what it means to have a default toward inclusion while still making individualized decisions, how to bring stakeholders along, and what happens when you miss a key group, and why middle and high school can be a great place to do this work when collaboration time and structures match the vision. We also dig into the fear of distraction and what students can teach adults about belonging, and how to stay flexible without sliding back into separate programs. And at the end, the mystery question gives us a glimpse into our younger selves. Before we meet our guest, I want to tell you about our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by IXL. IXL is an all-in-one platform for K-12 that helps boost student achievement, empowers teachers, and tracks progress in one place. As students practice, IXL adapts to their individual needs so that every learner gets just right support and challenge. And each student gets a personalized learning plan to close gaps. Check it out at IXL.com/inclusive. Again, that's IXL.com/inclusive. All right, after a quick break, it's time to think inclusive with Dr. Jennifer Spencer Imes. Catch you on the other side.
Are you looking for a Columbus car dealership built on tradition and trust? Byers Auto, family-owned since 1897, offers top new and pre-owned vehicles. Visit us or shop online at ByersAuto.com. Byers Auto, driving the next generation of buyers.
Jennifer Spencer Imes, welcome back to the Think Inclusive podcast.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. I'm such a fan. I listen all the time and get so much inspiration from the other voices that I hear that are all dedicated to this thing called inclusion.
Thank you so much. Thanks. And thanks for listening. Thanks to everyone who listens and watches, because I still really can't believe that I've been doing it for this long and that it's my job. So it is wild. Yeah. And to your point about, like, there are so many people doing really great work, and I think that that has always given me a lot of hope, right? I had this idea that when I first started that, oh yeah, there's people out there doing all this work and all this good stuff. But to be able to talk to people week after week and to share their stories, that has been really amazing. And you are one of those people.
Well, it's such a pleasure. And I feel that same way. I think I sent you an email after I listened to your long form series. I was so inspired and just getting to, you know, I get the opportunity to often talk with folks about our journey and where we've been. And it's so good, so affirming, so inspiring to hear others in that journey. And sometimes I just want to like get everyone together in one room and just hug each other and support each other. Let's keep doing this work.
I know. Yeah. And I feel like there's like, I don't know, I guess our stories just aren't flashy enough or viral enough because like if you could get everyone, like a million people into one room and hear the stuff that we hear, right? Don't you think that would really change people?
I do. Because, you know, once you dive into this work, there's really no going back. And I think many of the things that hold people back from going there, fear of change, fear that it's going to be hard, fear that they're maybe not going to meet everyone's needs as well as they want to meet them. Those are the same things that we work through in public education anyway, right? It is hard work. We are constantly evolving and trying to think about how is every student in our class, not just there, first there in our classrooms, but really learning at high levels, engaged, experiencing belonging with their peers. That's what we want for all students. So why not do it on the right side of history instead of in an old-fashioned segregated model? So, you know, I do think that when you see it, when you see this is doable, we can do this work, it would convince more people. And that's why I'm so glad that you share these stories so broadly.
Well, I really appreciate your kind words, and that you're here today. And speaking of you talking with people about this work, you know, you've been doing this work for a long time. So I'm wondering if, let's say you are at a coffee shop and you are talking with a friend and you're just talking about what has been going on in your district, and someone overhears you and is trying to figure out, okay, well, help me understand, like, how did this happen? Like, how did you move your district towards authentic inclusive practices? I'm really interested. So tell me a little bit more, Matt. What's like the first thing that you would say to them?
Well, you would think I'd have this down into a quick elevator speech since it is very common. That's actually a common scenario. And I think connecting back to the values that everyone who goes into education, they do it because they want to help kids. They want to make the world a better place and they want to meet the needs of children. And so when we are able to say, you know, about 13, 14, 15 years ago, as in our district, as we sat down and we thought, goodness, we are doing so many things well. There are lots of bright spots in our district, and we still are segregating some students with significant support needs. They're not attending their neighborhood schools. We're asking their families who are already navigating being parents of children with disabilities to often navigate being parts of two different school communities. We are not giving students access to everything that's happening in general education. And can we do better? So looking at the research, that's very clear that we can do better. And what inclusion means for us is a couple of things. Number one, no segregated classrooms. Everyone attends their neighborhood school. And then we work incredibly hard and collaboratively to individualize what students need, built on a foundation of practices like universal design for learning. So as we build the classroom, what the starting point is, when that works for more students, for almost all students, and we plan in that way, then we have the space to really individualize for students who really have significant support needs, where we may need to plan some different kinds of lessons for them. And it doesn't mean that a student can never be doing learning outside of the classroom. That's not individualized. Of course, we can do that when that works for a student and family and the educators are working together and they have a plan and it's intentional. We do that all the time. We also do that for students without IEPs. You know, if they need learning in a learning porch or somewhere off campus to practice a particular skill or access something, we can do that. So I think one of the myths of inclusion is it's a one size fits all, and that we're just taking students out of segregated spaces and just putting them into the general ed class that you remember in your mind. And what we're really doing is we're teaching differently. We're anticipating variability across every classroom. We expect, and when you expect that, you plan for it differently. You collaborate and use the expertise of multiple educators in the space, and that teaming becomes so paramount because each educator brings expertise about the content, about accessibility, about disability, around language acquisition, and we all need to work together. And when we do, we can have really inclusive and excellent schools where students are achieving at high levels. You know, one of the things that is really interesting, Timmy, have you ever looked into TAG education? Like, what are the best practices for talented and gifted students identified as talented and gifted?
I have some like personal experience with like exploring what talented or gifted education looks like, you know, in our family. So, but there's, I have always thought it strange that we separate kids to get something extra special, right, in gifted and talented programs, when the teaching that happens in those programs seems like it would benefit all learners, not just gifted and talented. So that's just what, that's just just my thoughts about that.
Well, I'm right there with you. In my previous district, I oversaw gifted education for a period of time, and I learned a lot. I went to a lot of conferences and learned a lot. I was like, wait a minute, these strategies, having some inquiry-based learning, allowing student choice, allowing different ways of representing and expressing learning, these line up exactly with universal design for learning, right? And so why are we thinking these have to be separate and only some students would get access to those? So as we've focused on inclusion and inclusive practices around no longer segregating students with significant support needs, and what are the instructional practices that can engage a wider range of students, we're also thinking about those students who need challenge and need engagement that maybe don't experience disability, may or may not be identified with this concept that has lots of thoughts around it, around talented and gifted. And when we do it well, we're engaging all of those students and finding pathways for them to experience success. So that was a real turning point for me also, to think about how when you actually break down the strategies that happen in a good, quote unquote, talented and gifted classroom or learning space, and the strategies that happen in a good universally designed learning space, they're really the same strategies. And so it actually affirms that when we do this well, it can really benefit all students.
Yes, absolutely. Gosh, I've talked to so many people that sometimes the stories that I remember, they get crossed. So I don't know who told me this story. But I remember it was something about a student being in a regular track of a particular department. Let's say, I don't know, let's say history or language arts or something like that. And so the expectations on that learner were not that high. They weren't exceptionally low, but they weren't like high. And until a teacher was like, I'm going to recommend you to go to the higher, quote unquote, or honors or gifted class. And the student is like, what, like, why? Like, you know, like, what is so special about me? And that made such a huge difference on the learner that the learner, after getting moved to this class and did exceptionally well and went off to do really great things, actually talked with the teacher like years later and said, why me? Like, why did you pick me? And the teacher said, I picked, you know, one or two students every semester. And I just said, these are the ones that I'm going to advocate to be moved up. And that was like, wow. It's not to say that this student isn't special or gifted or anything like that, but the fact that the teacher just made the decision to advocate for this learner, and that is the thing that made the difference in the learner. I was like, that is such a huge lesson, right? Like, we all need to be that teacher.
Those expectations and that identity with that is so incredibly powerful. And I think about that also when we have the low expectations of segregated classrooms. You know, what is it we're communicating to our students in that space? So when we understand both of those pieces, it feels very difficult. Back to your question about if I'm in a coffee shop and someone asked about that, you'd say, this is the right work. It's the right work for all kids. And when you dive into it, you need to engage everyone in your district. It is systems change. It's not just the special ed teacher in this one classroom. It's helping us all understand who belongs and how expectations matter and how we can adapt classrooms and systems to meet the needs of students. So I think we did some things pretty well early on in our district around engaging all stakeholders, and we had some misses. So I'll share both of those with you. We started in that first year with just talking with parents and really engaging parents that were, I would honestly say, kind of on both sides of very much pushing for change towards a more inclusive district, and a few that were very nervous about it or not asking for that. Talking with teachers, special ed teachers, general ed teachers, specialists, all of those folks, principals, district office folks. We did a really good job. We had an ongoing, we called it our Inclusive Schools Leadership Team. Second year, we started getting students involved. Remembered student voice, that's key. They were just absolutely huge in making that change. Our big miss was early on, we didn't involve our associations, the leadership of our unions. And that was a big miss. And so we learned that lesson pretty quickly. And now we have great connection with our associations. But if I were to do things over again, I would make sure in those stakeholders, you're absolutely connecting with those folks as well. And then I would say the next thing is to find friends in the work. Find others that are on this journey, wherever they are, no district's journey is exactly the same. For us, we found some other districts who were really having those goals and moving towards inclusive practices that we've maintained relationships with, where we do learning walks in each other's school districts every year. And we've done this now for, I think, 7 years, where we go into classrooms and we say, what are we seeing? And what are the things we're working on? Because seeing inclusion in action or inclusive practices in action really makes such a difference. So sometimes you need to bring new people into that journey. Maybe they're new teachers that have moved in, or a new board member who doesn't understand the why. Getting them into classrooms and seeing the benefits is huge. Things like Urban Collaborative, MCIE, if I were in Maryland, we'd be absolutely part of MCIE. But I've met several Maryland schools in Urban Collaborative, which is a great group. So just finding friends in the work. And then really trusting your professionals. Your teachers are amazing. They do incredible things. And understanding this is ready, fire, aim work. Like, you can't wait until you feel like everything is ready before you move. You do some getting ready, and then you move, and then you adjust. So because you learn the work through doing the work. And that's not to say, you know, throw caution to the wind and don't spend time working with your stakeholders and working through things together. But I've seen so many districts stay in the planning phase for years and years and years and still maintain segregated classrooms. So at some point, you have to just get in there and then keep adjusting as you go. So those would be probably my three big things I would think about if I were talking to someone else. It's the right work. We know it. We know it from a social justice point of view. We know it from a research point of view. We know it from a school climate and an anti-bullying point of view. There are districts that spend all this time working on anti-bullying, and yet the adults segregate students into a separate class and other them. And it's like, wait a minute. How do those things work together when we're trying to build inclusive schools? The other thing that I think we have learned so much is that as adults, we think we mean more to kids sometimes when it's really a lot about the peers, right? Mm. Teachers absolutely matter. We know teacher-student relationships matter. That's a high effect size in Hattie's research work. Teachers matter. Instructional practices matter. All those things matter. And kids learn so much from their peers. So when we keep peers separate or segregated and don't allow them to learn how to connect with each other, I think we're maybe overinflating our importance as teachers and under recognizing all the learning that happens between peers.
That's a good, I guess, counter argument to that this particular student is going to be disruptive to, you know, all, like the other kids in a classroom, right? Because the conventional wisdom is, well, you can't put these kids together because, you know, the students with that may be disruptive or that are talking or acting a little differently, that they're going to be so different that these students can't learn. But what I'm hearing you say is that they learn from each other. And so, and so the teacher, obviously, like you said, is important, but learning how to live and be in the same space together seems like a far more important lesson. After the break, we dig into what it really looks like to lead inclusion at the systems level, how districts make the shift, where they stumble, and why expectations and collaboration matter so much, especially as students get older. This episode is brought to you by Adaptiverse. If you're a special education teacher, you already know the time problem. Every week, educators spend 15 to 20 hours manually adapting curriculum for students with complex communication needs, non-speaking learners, AAC users, and students with apraxia or language-based disabilities. Creating personalized materials, building visual supports, and designing multiple expressive pathways is essential. But it's exhausting, and it pulls teachers away from actually teaching. Adaptiverse changes that. Teachers simply describe what they're teaching and who they're teaching, and the platform generates grade-level lessons personalized to each student, with built-in scaffolds and multiple ways to show understanding. These aren't watered-down worksheets. They're rigorous, engaging lessons that presume competence. Built on 60-plus years of combined education experience, Adaptiverse has already powered more than 2,000 lessons in 35 states, with educators calling it life-saving and irreplaceable. If you're ready to get those hours back and focus on what matters most, visit AdaptiverseApp.com to learn more. That's AdaptiverseApp.com.
Yes, I would affirm that. And little story from visiting a middle school class a couple years ago. We were just on a learning walk, and I was bringing some people from another district to visit and, you know, see inclusion in action. And I always warn people, it's a school, it's messy on any given day. I don't know what you're going to see, right? And we walked into a classroom and my first lens was, uh-oh, maybe this wasn't the right classroom to go into. I don't know the whole story, but a student with more extensive support needs was sitting a little to the side with a paraeducator, seeming to be doing something somewhat, it was a math class. He was doing something different. He was counting money, and it was a middle school math class. They were on some kind of quadrilateral equations or something. It felt pretty disconnected. And I was like, oh no, this isn't exactly what I wanted to show. And yet there was a peer sitting next to the student on the other side who's totally engaging with the student and working on whatever that student was working on. They were counting money back and forth. They were both laughing, having a great time. The teacher is teaching at the front. Again, this isn't ideal. You want it generally to be more connected. But this peer probably is very has a lot of strong cognitive skills, I'm going to guess, because he was able to, like, over here, I'm counting the money. Here, I'm answering the question to the equation, right, back and forth. Like, he had no problem keeping up with doing both things at once. The student with the extensive support needs was vocalizing some very happy vocalizations, but I thought, oh, is this distracting? So I sat down next to another student on the other side of the room. And I was like, hey, how's it going? What are you learning today? And she told me about equations. And I said, is it ever hard for you to learn with that student being a little noisy in the back of the class? And she looked at me. She's like, lady, he has a right to be here. This is his math class.
Oh, like, my gosh. Okay. Wow. You just got told.
I got told. But this is the thing that might not happen year one, right?
Right.
This is why you have to stay in it. And what's the culture and the beliefs that we're building about who belongs now? And I don't know if I worked with that teacher, maybe that was typical of how things are going and we need to work on instructional practices, or maybe it was just a moment in time. You have to be very careful when you pop in and out of classes to make too much judgment. But what was clear was this fear of distraction not only wasn't happening, kids were able to toggle back and forth really well, and what they were learning about accepting people and understanding difference, you really can't put a price on that.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That's great. And so what grade was that?
That was seventh grade.
Seventh grade. Okay, great, great. And that's a great example, because a lot of people say, like, you can't do this in, you know, the higher grades or middle school. And so I'm wondering about high school, because that is a common argument or criticism of just moving towards an inclusive model, that, well, it's easier to do it in the lower grades. It's easier to do it in elementary. It's even easier to do it in middle school. But once they get to high school, it's a whole different thing, and it just might not be worth doing. So I'm wondering if you have any examples from high school.
Yeah, you might not be surprised. I have some strong feelings about this and a lot of examples, because one, I actually think high school is a great place, as any school, but high school is a fantastic place to be inclusive. And there are some of the things that are built into high schools that actually support inclusive practices in really powerful ways. And a couple years ago, I had the opportunity to shift from primarily overseeing student services and pass that baton to the incredible Lauren Brigsby, who now leads that work in our district. She's amazing. And now I oversee our high schools. And so kind of from that general ed point of view, and I thought, this is good. Yeah, this is good. As an inclusive district, how do I hold those values and bring those over here? And where can we continue to grow and influence? So one of the things that we did, and that was the year we were coming out of COVID, and we knew we needed to change some things in our master schedule at high school. High school's, you know, master schedule rules all in secondary schools. And we had sort of a 6-period semester with some rotating blocks and we felt a lot of reasons we wanted to shift it. One of the reasons was I had been meeting with some of our high school teachers, and they got real with me and said, we all believe in inclusive practices, but we do not have time in our schedule for collaboration and co-planning. And that is what this, you know, this is one of the foundational practices. So, Jennifer, if you are saying we need to do this, there has to be some time and space in our schedule. So that coincided with also a study we'd done for all students in high schools around what they want out of high school, what are best practices in high school. And we realized we needed to change some things. We wanted more periods. We wanted less transitions. And so we spent a year studying this. What was kind of the inclusive way to think about it is we made sure learning specialists or special ed teachers and language specialists were part of that committee. So as a group, what are our guiding principles? What do we want from a schedule? Well, we want a schedule that gives kids more choice. We want a schedule that provides teachers time to collaborate. We want a schedule that has predictable transitions for kids. You know, we had like five things that we came to. And because we had those voices in that structural part, we ended up, though it took us a year to get there because, you know, things take time to do it in ways that everyone's going to own. So after a year, we decided on a new AB schedule. And then we took a year to plan implementation of it. And one of the foundations of it was something we called Life Class. And it's a class where students stay with the same cohort over 4 years, because one of the challenges in a large comprehensive high school is, do kids get lost? And I think that's one of the reasons segregated classes have maintained at high school is, you know, we're worried a student with significant support needs, how are they feeling really connected? So Life Class, you build that connection. You stay with the same teacher and the same kids for all 4 years. In Life Class, we build in some of the executive functioning lessons that, frankly, all ninth graders need. How do I organize myself? How do I study? Some of the planning for 11th and 12th graders that we often did in segregated spaces around transition planning are built into Life Class, because they may look a little different, but everyone needs to be planning for post-high school in 11th and 12th grade. So taking some of those good ideas from that special education lens, and how can we embed them in ways that are more universally designed? Also, that's a time where intervention or extension can happen for kids. We call it an access period, where they can go meet with a teacher that they are behind in a class or don't understand something. So it could be a content teacher, it could be their learning specialist, it could be any of those things. So it's also provided some time for community building, school assemblies and contests and things like that also happen during Live Class. So by taking the time to build more universally a structure that works at high school for more kids. The other thing that happens at high school is you get to choose electives. You get to choose activities. You get to choose. Kids are thinking so much about their identity in high school, whether it's their racial identity, whether it's a religious identity, whether it's, I'm really into anime, I'm really into this sport, I really want to do mock trial, I want to do speech and debate. Because you have those things, there are natural spaces where students can find community. So back when we first started our journey, one of our goals was that all students who are served by an IEP are in at least one co-curricular activity. So that's been a written down goal for us for years. In the high school setting, as we provide opportunity and then when we need to, some scaffolding or support to get there. So just, you know, high schools, you have that space for an affinity group. So if you have one of the pushbacks around not having segregated classes is it's natural for some students who have disabilities to want to spend some time together. Right? Absolutely. Same with, you know, like we have a, you know, Latino student union group, right? That is valid and worthy. And so we want to allow students to opt into affinity spaces And that may be about their identity, or it might be about a shared interest. Mm-hmm. So, and we're not predetermining for that for them, but providing them those opportunities to get there. The other thing at the high school level that we've been investing in, especially in the last couple of years, is that professional learning for all teachers around universal design for learning. Back to that conversation we were having before, but in a high school class, you've got students who are, you know, reading at vastly different levels. You've got students who are interested in vastly different things and motivated by different things. So having that universal design lens, we actually worked with Katie Novak's group, Chris Bronke, who's a high school teacher, came out and did PD. And now, because I'm in charge of high schools, I got to make sure that all high school teachers did that PD. a couple of sessions with him, and they've done studio groups focusing on universal design for learning. So when you step back and use that inclusive lens as you think about what do we want our high schools to be anyway, it is a great place to be inclusive. Kids are very into social justice also at high school. So it's a wonderful place to build that connection.
Those are great examples. And if you are listening and thinking like, oh, I think I could do this in my high school, make sure you share this episode and conversation with your, you know, high school administrator or assistant superintendent, associate superintendent, you know, directors of teaching and learning. People need to know that there's other schools and districts out here in the world doing this work. So I appreciate all of those examples. I wanted to ask about, we've talked about learners with more extensive support needs being included. And I think for some people that isn't as big of a stretch as the learner who maybe has a, you know, like a math, disability or a learning disability. And maybe you have educators who believe that those particular learners need a separate space where they are being given specialized instruction in a small group, and that they're committed to doing that because that's what they've been doing for so long. So I'm wondering if how would you talk with an educator who is maybe on board with like, okay, I get extensive support needs, that learners with extensive support needs can be included and how to modify and stuff like that. But for these kids, they really need something special. Like what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think the research and work around strong MTSS systems provides a good framework for thinking about that. In our own district, we looked at our literacy curriculum and found that our tier one needed some work in mm-hmm. our elementary schools, so that we were having a lot of students referred for learning disabilities and reading, and really took a hard look at could we do a better job about teaching a lot of those foundational reading skills in the early grades. So we've been going through that as many districts have been, realigning curriculum that way. So as we think about what do all kids need, this is where I might think about us, describe us as having a default towards inclusion, default towards being in the general ed classroom, and looking at what is the instruction that's happening in the general ed classroom and how can that best meet their needs. That's a default. It's not an exclusive, though. So we always start there. But the ultimate goal, if you have a student who's really struggling to learn how to read, and where we've made sure the general ed curriculum is really teaching the skills the student needs, we're looking at sort of within that general ed classroom, how can that teacher pull the student for some very explicit work a couple times during the day or a couple times during the week and monitoring that. and we're watching their progress and they're not making progress, well, then it's time to do something different. So that's where you default towards the time in the classroom. You really work on saying, is the classroom providing the skills and support the students need? And then you hold some flexibility as you monitor that child's progress. So it's not, I think what we're trying to shift away from is, I believe in this model of pulling kids out and teaching them this way, or I believe in this model of the student can only be in the classroom all day, every day, but default to the classroom. Make sure the instruction is really strong there. Make sure you've built in opportunities for repetition, practice, reteaching, in the structure of your workshop model or whatever it is you're doing in the classroom. But then ultimately that child deserves to learn how to read. So if you're not making progress on that, don't hold that so precious that you're afraid to bring a couple kids together and work on those explicit skills and help them gain that confidence. And if that's outside the classroom, that's fine. If it's inside the classroom, that's fine. And again, you're also, how is the student reacting to that? Because there are students who being pulled out of the classroom is devastating to them. They feel like, again, that sense of belonging. They might feel othered. They might feel like their expectations are down. There are other kids that's the exact opposite. I'm like, thank God someone's teaching me to read. And I wasn't getting it in the classroom. So that you hold as an, I'll use your term, as an inclusionist, you hold that default to what's happening in the classroom, the building, the belonging, and trying to make sure the skills are taught there. But never get so entrenched in that you are not allowing yourself to make individualized decisions to meet that child's needs and making sure they're making progress.
Yeah, that's a great point. And being flexible with the arrangement of students and instructors and teachers, but being committed to full inclusion and belonging, and just being responsive. I think that inclusive schools are responsive schools, and they respond to the needs of learners. But that's not to say that they create all these separate programs, right? Because that is what we are trying to get away from.
Yeah. And I think one of the things we're trying to do better is improve our tools and systems for monitoring that progress so that we're keeping better tabs on that. So, which I think probably every school is working on, no matter what their model is, but that we're intervening sooner. And intervening doesn't necessarily mean here or there. It's that responsive, flexible, with the default towards the classroom always.
Right. I'm wondering if you could help our listeners understand what's happening in Oregon right now. Is there anything that's Oregon specific that's on top of your mind when it comes to like education, the educational landscape?
It's so interesting. I joined a group last year of other district office folks through AASA, and it was really fun to connect with people in that group. We're from Mississippi and New Hampshire and Wisconsin, Florida, and I guess you kind of get in your own bubble, and I was not aware of how many differences there are around the country, or I try to be aware, but it just hit home in some different ways. So I appreciate you asking that question. Oregon is a state where we have had strong leadership from the Department of Education around issues of equity. And I believe inclusion is an issue of equity. And so that's really great. And we have a strong law called the All Students Belong Act that is in our state that is really powerful. At the same time, some of our challenges are funding We're struggling with funding. Just keeping up on the basic school funding does not match the rising in costs every year. I don't think we're unique in that as a state, but it's certainly something we are feeling deeply. So that is quite a challenge. The other piece is I'm having a little envy right now for the state of Washington.
oh, it's so close too.
I know. That they have taken such a strong leadership stance to support inclusive practices around their state. And we're just not in that same place. So we're a little more grassroots right now. We're banding together as district leaders and trying to build those coalitions ourselves. My incredible superintendent, Dr. Kathy Ludwig, and I had started a group called the Inclusive Schools Leadership Collaborative. And started off, it was just trying to get other superintendents to get excited about inclusion and realize this is an issue of equity just as much as any of our other issues of equity, and that this is something we can change. It's been a powerful but small group meeting together and trying to inspire and bring some resources forward. We just had the great opportunity to have Shelley Moore come in the Monday before school started, and we ended up inviting folks from all over the state to come, and we got a lot of colleagues from all around coming, and they said, join our collaborative, like, let's keep this work going. So we're in the initial stages of that collaborative, moving from Kathy and I kind of trying to rally that with a few other key partners to getting some broader support around the state. And our coalition of Oregon school administrators has now signed on to help sponsor that. So that's nice to get a little sponsorship that gives it a little more bona fides and gets it in front of more people. So we'll have our first meeting with that group next week. So we're trying, because that, I'm going to go back to your story about the student and how he got recommended to the honors class, mm-hmm. and the somewhat random nature, it seems like, that for that teacher. You know, it is all of our responsibility to do this work, because right now a student, if you take, say, example, a student who experiences an intellectual disability, and you say, what is the biggest factor that may indicate that they would be in a segregated classroom? You might think, is it they need a communication device? Is it behavior? Is it, is it an IQ score? You know, what is that factor that's most predictive of segregation? Now, you are in this work, so you probably know the answer, Tim.
I think I do. It's where they live, right? It's basically what school you go to, yes. and the willingness of the people who work there to include them.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's not right. It shouldn't be, your zip code shouldn't determine your ability to be included with your peers or to access the general education curriculum. So that motivates us to keep working with our colleagues and try to move this work forward. It's messy. We don't have it all figured out. We are in process at all times on any given day. You know, there's things going really well and challenging things too, but we have to all be in that work. It is not right that it is your zip code that predicts that. So we have to stay in this. And that is a challenge. I would say the other thing for Oregon right now that may be common for educators all around the country is, you know, some of the leadership that we may have looked to the Department of Education for in the past, or it's in a different space. So that can alternately feel very discouraging or very motivating, like light a fire under you. Motivating of why we need to all be supporting public education right now. So those are the emotions I think folks are going back and forth between, along with looking for ways to stabilize school funding in general. Those are the things that are really on our minds.
So, Jennifer, do you have any go-to examples that inclusion works? You have shared a lot of really great stories, and I'm wondering if there is like one that you typically go to when you're talking about, does inclusion really work?
I have so many. It is hard to pick one because I have the joy of being able to stay in one space for this period of time. I've gotten to see student after student after student, but I think I want to tell you the story of a student named Ryder. And that last year, I just happened to be at one of our high schools. And this is a student I've known since kindergarten. So when he came in kindergarten, we still had a self-contained classroom. So he was in we called it communication resource classroom, but it was a classroom that was somewhat focused around the needs of students who experience autism. And so he started there, and then as we moved to being more inclusive, he moved to being at his home school, and it's kind of been this whole arc of the journey. So I'm at the high school. School is ending. Kids are getting on buses. It's a little chaotic. I was really there to just see if the buses were leaving on time. Honestly, that was my reason for being there. And the buses were getting out. And then I noticed the last bus was left, and there are three students still standing there. Two of them are throwing a football to each other, and I'm thinking they didn't have any intention of getting on the bus. They're fine. And then I saw Ryder, again, the student I've known since kindergarten, the student with autism, and he looks a little distraught. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, should I go intervene, check in with him? I know him. He doesn't know me, though. That's what happens a lot at school administration. So I think I'll just kind of hang back a little bit and see what he does and intervene if he needs it. So he's a little frustrated. He starts walking back towards the school and heads to the back door. And there are some other students just hanging out there, and he's frustrated, looks anxious. And the students that are standing by the door say, "Hey, Ryder, what's happening? Are you okay?" And he says, I missed my bus. And the students say, "Oh, I'm so sorry that happened to you. And then one of the other students says, "Oh, did you know that I know where you live? The city bus goes near your house. Have you ever ridden the city bus before?" And I'm thinking, oh, I hope we don't send him on the city bus for his first time. But one of the other students says, "Well, maybe before you decide about the city bus, Ryder, maybe do you just want to go in and call your parents and see if they have some ideas for you?" And he's like, yeah, I'll call my parents. And then he's like, "I don't know where the phone is." And one of the other students says, "I'll walk you to the office." And he walked him in, and they called, and the parents. But that interaction right there had so many elements to it about why inclusion works. Because number one, Ryder is developing problem solving skills. He knew to go back inside. In many schools, he would have been fully supervised, you know, paraeducator velcroed to his side. And he was within the safety of the school setting, able to go back in. Those students knew him. They've known him for years. They understand that he needed a little more support. But they also know he's a high school kid, and they treated him as such, with belonging and care and dignity. So that to me was just a great unscripted moment that I came across that really is sticking with me right now.
That is a great story. That's a great story. Yeah, they didn't try to fix the problem necessarily, right? They supported him through the problem.
Yes.
You know, it could have been very easy for them to be, like, "Oh, I'm going to get an adult," you know?
Or to ignore him.
Or more likely, like, "Oh my gosh, what is happening here?
Yes.
Let's go over here. Let's get out of the way," you know?
Yes.
Wow, that's great. Thank you so much for sharing. I love that. I love that so much. Okay, last question before we get the mystery question. Where do you look for inspiration and guidance in this work?
last year we got to host the Urban Collaborative along with Portland Public Schools over out here in Portland, which was amazing to have colleagues from around the country come out that all care deeply about inclusion. And in preparing for that, we held a couple of panels. One was a student panel and students with and without disabilities. And these were high school students that spoke about why it matters to them that we have an inclusive school district. And it was so inspiring. And I get to experience that all the time being there, but to see them up in front of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people from around the country talking about why this is important, why they think this should be happening in every school, was really powerful. We also had a panel called, we liked to call them the OGs, our original gangster teachers, the teachers that have been here through the whole transition, both special ed and general ed teachers. They are amazing. And it's great to capture their voices about, you know, the joys, the missteps, the where areas we've had to learn more, the places we're still learning. They are so inspiring to me, and to continue to check in with them about how this work is going and how we can do better. So I think our students, our teachers, our parents, they inspire me. They are committed, they're dedicated, they push us as they should. We have a bond coming up that will include, if it passes, it will include redoing all of our primary school or elementary school playgrounds to be more inclusive in the surfacing and all of that, because we've had parents that continue to advocate. So it's right there in our bond. So I think within our own community, I get a lot of inspiration. The amazing administrators that we work with here and principals that work through the hard situations that come up every day and keep that belief. Beyond that, I'm going to say, you know, we've had the opportunity to meet and work with some incredible people that Bernier's out and screened their film for our entire school district. And Hilda and Olivier were just so lovely, and Emilio and their younger daughter, and just getting connected with them and their story. We've had Paula Kluth out. As I said, we just had Shelley Moore. I got to meet one of my heroes in the work, Michael Giangreco.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. Getting to connect with, you know, I certainly watch what comes out of Katie Novak's group all the time, the Thai Center, Swift Center. Those are a lot of the resources that we go to, and the Think Inclusive podcast.
Thank you. I wasn't trying to lead you to say that, but.
Well, I was listening to your episode with Samuel Habib, as I was driving in today, and we got to meet them when they screened The Ride Ahead at Urban Collaborative in New York last year. And such a powerful story, and this idea of highlighting the voices of folks who experience disability. I believe in that so much that sometimes I'm like, why are you talking to me? You know, what am I doing?
Right.
Not,
yeah.
That's not my, I don't have that personal experience. And then I remember that in changing systems, the people that are leading those systems have a responsibility. They have to step up, and they have to also be vocal about the need for change and do it when they can do it. So that's what keeps me coming back.
That's fantastic. So I do want to mention your book, which is on my shelf, Leading for All. Do you have an updated version, or is it you coming up with another book or anything like that? Any news, any scoop? Well,
first shout out to my co-author, Dr. Josh Flossie, who we worked together and co-authored it. And then he went off to lead inclusive work at an international school in Tanzania, which is so cool. He's now back in Oregon. So I'm excited about that. We don't have an updated version. It's still pretty current. It's just a couple years old. but I have been thinking about and have an outline for another book where I focus a little bit more on some of it featuring high schools, because it's interesting that you asked me about that today.
It's because that's a huge need.
Such yes. My lens these last few years. And I feel like there isn't a lot of literature out there. So that is what I think we are going to start working on next.
Oh, that's great. That's great. More breaking news on the Think Inclusive podcast. If you're a book publisher, you just knock on Jennifer's door, send her an email. Okay. Let's make this happen. Make this happen. Oh, awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much. And then if anyone wants to reach out to you, can we include your email in the show notes?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah, we'll
absolutely.
Do that.
Absolutely. We are, as I said, we host people here. We have been, joined team meetings or district launches to whatever extent you would find that helpful. We feel like this is our role in the world. There are other things. There are other ways where we're not probably going to be leading the work, and we're not the most racially diverse district. We're not the most, we have some other things where we're probably not the ones to be out front leading the work. So we take this responsibility to try to lead in this area wherever we can.
We've talked about what it takes to lead inclusive systems, why expectations matter so much, and how students and peers play a huge role in belonging. But before we wrap it up, it's time for the mystery question. And this one takes us back to an earlier chapter in our lives. Okay, well, since you are a listener of the podcast, you know about the mystery question.
Yeah. Very excited.
So the only kind of wrinkle to this is that my daughter, who typically writes the questions, we are out of questions. There's no more 13-year-old questions. But I was like, how am I going to do this? Because I have a few more, and she's very busy and, I love her, but she's got a million things at once.
Yes.
So I do have kind of a workaround. And I don't know if I need to explain it, but it's like a list of just questions, and we'll pick something randomly and we'll both answer it. So here we go. Here we go. We're going to, okay. So the random mystery question is, what was your first car? And
ooh.
I guess if you have any story about your first car, if you want, I can go first if you want.
Yeah, you go.
Okay. Okay. So, my first car was a Mitsubishi Montero, and my dad at the time drove the car, and then he got a promotion at work, and he had this fancy job, right? And so he bought a really fancy luxury car, and I was very fortunate and privileged, obviously, to be gifted this car in high school when I think I was a junior when I got the car. And I did not take care of that car.
As 16-year-olds do.
I did not do oil changes. I did not there's so many things that I wish I could have done differently with that car, because it's such a great car. But I drove that thing all the time and into the ground. And what happened to that car was, I was driving on the freeway in Southern California, and all of a sudden the car overheated, and it's just smoke everywhere. And I had to pull it over. Turns out whatever I had done or not done to the car, it cracked the engine block.
Oh no.
So that car was no longer after that. Cause it was basically the cost of fixing the car was more than what the car was worth. So I had that car. It was a great car. I have many fond memories. But
special place in your heart.
Did not take care of it. Take care of our cars now.
Yeah.
All right, what about you? Who was your first car?
I did not have a car in high school or college. So I didn't get a car until I just graduated from college and I was going to start my first year teaching kindergarten.
Oh, wow.
At 21. But it was a sweet car. It was a Peugeot 604. So an older French car.
Beautiful, it was a kind of French car.
Yes, Peugeot.
Wow.
Yes. And it had beautiful old leather seats that were like a worn-in bomber jacket and a Blaupunkt stereo. And I think it was a horrible gas guzzler, but it felt very luxurious. So I loved that car so much. But much like yours, it was, I got into a fender bender after about 6 months. Mm-hmm. And it would have cost so much more to fix it than it was worth. So it was total.
Oh, no, you only got to drive it 6 months. Oh, no.
But that, those seats, that stereo, that sunroof. It was lovely.
Oh, man. Oh, that's a bummer. That is a bummer. Okay. Well, now I have to look up the car. So it's, I'll look it up after, but that is fantastic. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. All right. We did it. Jennifer Spencer Imes, thank you so much for being on the Think Inclusive podcast.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Jennifer Spencer Imes. One thing I'm really sitting with after this conversation is how much inclusion is about the everyday systems we build or don't build around people. Jennifer kept coming back to expectations, peer relationships, and the idea that belonging isn't something you can just attach on later. It's something you design for from the start. I also keep thinking about how often segregation gets justified as being easier or more realistic when what we're really talking about is adult comfort, not student need. If we want schools where every learner belongs, we have to be willing to shift schedules, roles, and assumptions and trust that kids are capable of learning with and from each other. One practical step for educators is to look honestly at whether collaboration is actually built into our day. If we believe inclusive schools are a team effort, and I think you do, then general education teachers, special education teachers, specialists, anyone who is involved with educating learners need real time to plan together, not just goodwill and best intentions squeezed into lunch or before or after school. If this episode resonated with you, share it with a colleague who's building inclusive schools. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and follow Think Inclusive wherever you get your podcasts. Shout out to every school leader who is working to make their schools more inclusive. I know you are out there. If you want to share your journey, no matter where you are in that journey, you can always email me at tvagus@mcie.org. I'd love to know what is happening in your school or district. Now, let's roll the credits. Think Inclusive is brought to you by me, Tim Viegas. I write, edit, mix, master. I basically wear all the podcast hats and the baseball caps. This show is a proud production of the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education, scheduling and extra production help from Jill Wagoner. Our original music is by Miles Kredich with extra vibes from Melody. Big thanks to our sponsor, IXL. Visit IXL.com/inclusive. Another big thanks to our other sponsor, Adaptiverse. Visit Adaptiverse at AdaptiverseApp.com. Fun fact, February 20th is Love Your Pet Day, and research funded by the NIH shows that interacting with animals can lower stress hormones like cortisol, reduce blood pressure, and increase feelings of social support. And that includes students with disabilities. Studies found that children on the autism spectrum were calmer and more socially engaged when playing with guinea pigs in the classroom. And kids with ADHD showed better focus and social skills when reading to therapy dogs. Even watching fish swim can promote calm, reminding us that inclusion and connection sometimes start with the most unexpected relationships. Have you ever used animals to create an inclusive classroom? I'd love to know about it. Email me at tviegas@mcie.org. I read every single message. If you've made it this far, you're officially part of the Think Inclusive Inclusion crew. Want to help us keep moving the needle for inclusion? Head to mcie.org and click the donate button. Give $5, $10, $20. It helps us keep partnering with schools and districts to move inclusive practices forward and support educators doing the work. Find us on the socials almost everywhere at Think Inclusive. Thanks for hanging out. And remember, inclusion always works.
From MCIE.
Podcast roll. Welcome in.